Doors open, his house in ruins, and a note from the federal agency that read, "Nothing found." And just 3 weeks before the raid in Waco, ATF agents raided a woman's home in Portland. They held her at gunpoint for several hours and wouldn't let her call her attorney. They finally admitted that they had raided the wrong home. These were just a few examples of the agency's excesses. The ATF abuses that came to light in the 1990s were a good indication that the warrior-like, us-against-them mentality wasn't limited to drug policing. Those police actions also gave some momentum to a new militia movement, or at least caused the media to take notice of them. The militia movement was vast and fairly diverse, but most groups had views about government, guns, and property that were well to the right of the rest of the country. Very few espoused violence, but the new attention on the few that did, along with anger from the National Rifle Association, NRA, Gun Owners of America, and the rants of right-wing personalities like Liddy, inspired more reactionary opposition from the left. Then, on April 19, 1994, Timothy McVeigh set off a fertilizer bomb outside the Arthur Murrah Federal Building in Oklahoma City, killing 164 people. McVeigh claimed that he bombed the building in retaliation for the events at Waco. McVeigh's act gave fresh fuel to the ATF's defenders, not so much to defend the agency, but to attack its critics. 4 days after the bombing, President Bill Clinton laid part of the blame at the feet of right-wing critics of federal law enforcement officials. We hear so many loud and angry voices in America today whose sole goal seems to be to try to keep some people as paranoid as possible, and the rest of us all torn up and upset with each other, Clinton said. They spread hate. They leave the impression that, by their very words, that violence is acceptable. Of course, just as it was possible to think David Koresh was a madman and be appalled by the federal government's siege at Waco, it was also possible to believe the ATF deserved sharp criticism for its handling of both Ruby Ridge and Waco, and be appalled at Timothy McVeigh's retaliatory murder of 164 innocent people. But McVeigh's actions seemed to cement partisan battle lines for years to come, at least when it came to ATF abuses. The final event to nudge the right to question the militarization of police, at least at the federal level, was the raid to wrest 5-year-old Cuban refugee Elian Gonzalez from the home of his relatives in Miami. In November 1999, Gonzalez had fled to Florida on a boat with his mother and her boyfriend. His mother drowned when the boat sank, but Gonzalez was picked up by a Florida fisherman, then handed over to Immigration and Naturalization Service, INS, officials, who initially placed him with the Miami relatives. When word of his rescue made it back to Cuba, Gonzalez's father said that his mother had taken the boy without his permission, and he immediately began agitating for his son's return. A legal battle ensued, culminating with a decision by the 11th Circuit Court of Appeals on April 19th that Gonzalez was to be returned to Cuba. When informed of the decision by a Justice Department official, Elian's cousin, Marisleses Gonzalez, allegedly responded, "You think we just have cameras in the house? If people try to come in, they could be hurt." The Justice Department cited that statement and other threats from the family's supporters as the reason for its decision to send a 130-member INS team to take custody of the boy, headed by a heavily armed 8-member INS SWAT team. The resulting raid produced an iconic Pulitzer Prize-winning photo by Associated Press photographer Alan Diaz, in which an INS agent points a semi-automatic weapon at the crying, terrified boy while he's being held by Donato Dalrymple, one of the fishermen who found him. Once again, reactions to the raid and the photo broke down along partisan lines. Conservatives lined up behind the Miami relatives, who were part of the city's large community of generally conservative, anti-Castro, anti-communist Cuban immigrants. Liberals tended to line up behind Bill Clinton, Janet Reno, and the Justice Department, who were trying to enforce the 11th Circuit ruling. Then-presidential candidate George W. Bush declared that the chilling picture of a little boy being removed from his home at gunpoint defies the values of America. Bush would go on to win the presidency, a position from which he would order heavily armed SWAT teams to raid AIDS and cancer patients who used medical marijuana in states that had legalized the drug for medical purposes. The conservative Washington Times compared the INS agents to the Nazi brownshirts in the movie Schindler's List. And conservative bomb thrower and drug war cheerleader Ann Coulter deplored the pre-dawn raid with masked machine gun-toting federal agents breaking into a private home. Yet, as Chicago Tribune columnist Clarence Page pointed out, heavily armed INS SWAT teams had been breaking into private homes and businesses to snatch up nonviolent but undocumented immigrants for years, thanks to policies passed and funded by the Republican Congress, and with the full support of anti-immigration conservatives. Meanwhile, on the left, former Clinton Solicitor General Walter Dellinger pointed out that, of course, SWAT teams like the one in the Gonzalez photo look scary. That's the whole point. A great show of force can often avoid violence, Dellinger said on ABC's This Week. It allowed the INS agents to get in and out in 3 minutes. Look again at that iconic picture, and you will see that Mr. Dalrymple is stunned by the officer in his display of a weapon. His jaw goes slack, his arm loses its grip, and that avoided a physical tug of war. Slate writer Will Salatin explained that the INS agents were heavily armed because Justice Department officials had heard there might be weapons in the house. They were wrong, but they weren't reckless. These are the very same justifications SWAT teams across the country give for conducting violent, heavily armed raids on people suspected of nonviolent drug crimes. As police militarization began to creep beyond the drug war into other police actions in the 1990s, the country's major political ideologies continued to react through the prism of partisan affiliation. When George W. Bush moved into the White House in 2001, conservatives stopped caring about police heavy-handedness, though there were a few exceptions. Progressives then rose up to decry the raids on medical marijuana clinics and the disproportionate use of SWAT teams and paramilitary tactics against minority groups, on immigration raids, and at political protests. Both sides were capable of righteous anger when the opposing party was in power and using big guns to enforce policies they found objectionable. And at the same time, both sides were more than willing to endorse the use of heavy-handed police tactics on their political opponents. It's a trend that continues today and further enables domestic police militarization to continue to flourish. In 1989, a friend asked Peter Kraska if he wanted to tag along for a U.S. Coast Guard exercise on Lake Erie. Kraska is a criminologist at the University of Eastern Kentucky. His students describe him as demanding, whip-smart, and, in the words of one female student, a strangely hot lumberjack. He agreed to go along, mostly out of curiosity. While on that trip, Kraska learned that the Coast Guard worked closely with the U.S. Navy on drug interdiction efforts. The Navy itself would intercept boats or ships that fit drug courier profiles, but would then have Coast Guard personnel on board to conduct the actual searches, seizures, and arrests. One Coast Guard officer flatly admitted to Kraska that the procedure was a way of getting around the Navy's policy prohibiting its personnel from participating in civil police actions. Kraska was both alarmed and intrigued. The experience started him down a road of scholarship focused on examining the ways in which the U.S. military was increasingly being drawn into enforcing drug laws. In particular, Kraska began looking into indirect militarization, the rise of SWAT teams and other paramilitary police teams, what might be called the criminal justice industrial complex, and the increasing tendency of public officials to address social problems with martial rhetoric and imagery, and to suggest military-like solutions, from the wars on crime and drugs to the heavy weaponry and vehicles that police were beginning to use, to the proposals that juvenile offenders be punished in boot camps. Kraska obtained funding to conduct two broad surveys of police departments on their use of SWAT teams. His resulting reports systematically documented a previously unheeded two-decade insurgence of militarism into just about every city and county in America. The numbers were staggering. By 1995, 89% of American cities with 50,000 or more people had at least one SWAT team, double the percentage from 1980. Among smaller cities, populations between 25,000 and 50,000, 65% had a SWAT team by 1995, a 157% increase over 10 years. Nearly 20% of all police officers in these towns served on the SWAT team, a phenomenon that Kraska dubbed the militarization of Mayberry. By 1995, combining these figures for cities and towns, 77% of all American cities with over 25,000 people had a SWAT team. Kraska then asked police departments that had maintained SWAT teams going back to the early 1980s to report how many times the teams had been deployed over the years and for what reasons. Again, the numbers were jaw-dropping. In the early 1980s, the aggregate annual number of SWAT deployments was just under 3,000. By 1995, it was just under 30,000. In 15 years, the number of annual SWAT team deployments in America had jumped by 937%. Some SWAT teams, Kraska found, were conducting up to 700 raids per year. What was precipitating the surge in SWAT activity? The drug war, almost exclusively. Logan, Utah, is a typical example of the phenomenon. As of 2011, the city had just under 50,000 people, hadn't had a murder in 5 years, and had recently been rated the safest city in America. Yet, since the mid-1980s, Logan has had its own SWAT team. What does a SWAT team do in a city with no violent crime? It creates violence out of nonviolent crime. We haven't really had a whole lot of barricaded subjects, and certainly we haven't had an active gunman shooter, a department spokesman told the local paper. But it was nice to have the SWAT team around just in case. In the meantime, he said, it's mostly used for assistance on high-risk search warrants. High-risk, meaning all or most drug warrants. We've destroyed some doors over the years that maybe wouldn't have gotten destroyed if there wasn't a SWAT team, but it's all in the name of trying to make a high-risk situation more safe for everyone. Some 43% of the police departments in Kraska's survey told him that they had used active-duty military personnel to train the SWAT team when it was first started, and 46% were training on a regular basis with active-duty military experts in special operations, usually the Army Rangers or Navy SEALs. This was the goal of the joint task forces set up during the Bush administration, to encourage cooperation between local police, federal police, and the military in order to foster a battlefield approach to drug enforcement. In a follow-up interview, one department's SWAT commander told Kraska, "We've had special forces folks who have come right out of the jungles of Central and South America. These guys get into the real shit. All branches of military service are involved in providing training to law enforcement. U.S. Marshals act in liaisons between the police and military to set up the training, our go-between. We've had teams of Navy SEALs and Army Rangers come here and teach us everything. We just have to use our judgment and exclude the information like, at this point, we bring in the mortars and blow the place up." The commander added that he had received a letter from a 4-star general expressing concern about the sort of training the department was getting. Back in the 1850s, the Cushing Doctrine had allowed federal marshals to summon U.S. troops to enforce domestic law. More than 100 years after the controversial policy was repealed by the Posse Comitatus Act, federal marshals were now soliciting elite U.S. military personnel again, not to enforce domestic law themselves, but to teach civilian police officers how to enforce the laws as if they were in the military. Perhaps most disturbing was Kraska's finding that these paramilitary police teams and aggressive tactics were increasingly being used even for regular patrols. By 1997, 20% of the departments he surveyed used SWAT teams or similar units for patrol, mostly in poor, high-crime areas. This was an increase of 257% since 1989. SWAT proponents argued that all of this buildup was in response to a real problem. After all, violent crime had soared in the 1980s and early 1990s. But the SWAT teams weren't generally responding to violent crime. They were usually serving drug warrants. When Kraska and colleague Louis Cabellas compared changes in violent crime rates to changes in the use of SWAT teams in the jurisdictions they surveyed, they found that only 6.63% of the rise in SWAT deployments could be explained by the rising crime rate. Kraska's findings prompted a surge of media interest in the phenomenon of police militarization. The New York Times, Washington Post, Boston Globe, National Journal, and ABC News all covered Kraska's study and also ran their own investigations into the issue. But nothing really changed. Politicians and policymakers didn't seem to notice, or if they did, they didn't much care. Kraska noted the fizzling out of the issue in a self-deprecating footnote in a book he edited a few years later. What exactly all this media attention accomplished is not quite clear. It resulted in no fame, no money, and no appreciable difference in the phenomenon itself. Of course, that wasn't Kraska's fault. Congress, state legislatures, and other politicians either weren't paying attention or just didn't find the reports particularly troubling. In fact, the phenomenon only continued to pick up momentum. The year before Kraska's reports were published, Congress had passed the National Defense Authorization Security Act of 1997, the biennial bill to fund the Pentagon. One provision in the bill created what is now usually called the 1033 program, named for the section of U.S. code assigned to it. The provision established the Law Enforcement Support Program, an agency headquartered in Fort Belvoir, Virginia. Its mission? To further grease the pipeline through which hardcore military gear flows to civilian police agencies. It certainly accomplished its mission. In its first 3 years, the office handled 3.4 million orders for Pentagon gear from 11,000 police agencies in all 50 states. By 2005, the number of police agencies serviced by the office hit 17,000. National Journal reported in 2000 that between 1997 and 1999, the office doled out $727 million worth of equipment, including 253 aircraft, notably 6- and 7-passenger airplanes and UH-60 Black Hawk and UH-1 Huey helicopters, 7,856 M-16 rifles, 181 grenade launchers, 8,131 bulletproof helmets, and 1,161 pairs of night vision goggles. With all that military gear, plus the federal drug policing grants and asset forfeiture proceeds, just about anyone running a police department who wanted a SWAT team could now afford to start and fund one. And so the trend crept into smaller and smaller towns. By the mid-2000s, SWAT had come to Middleburg, Pennsylvania, population 1,363, Leesburg, Florida, 17,000, Mount Oreb, Ohio, 2,701, Nina, Wisconsin, 24,507, Harwich, Massachusetts, 11,000, and Butler, Missouri, 4,201, among others. In research for his ethnography on militarization, Kraska spent a good deal of time with cops and SWAT teams in these smaller cities. One general dynamic he observed was a kind of masculinity-infused arms race between police agencies that could often lead to an inferiority complex at smaller departments. These officers strongly believed that small municipalities and county police were being left behind by not having special tactical teams, Kraska writes. Smaller departments may have started acquiring SWAT teams not because of a sudden surge in violence or hostage takings or even drug activity. The town's police departments simply saw that other police departments had them, so they wanted one too. Neil Franklin, a former narcotics cop in Maryland, also witnessed the dynamic over the course of his career. It's almost like they would get their own high off the money and the equipment, and then the agencies would get competitive. If a city department had a SWAT team, the county wanted one. If one department upgraded to a more powerful gun or got an APV, all the departments nearby had to get the same thing. Stephen Downing, who worked in the same LAPD patrol bureau as Darryl Gates while Gates was developing his SWAT idea, explains how the move to smaller police departments makes already dangerous SWAT raids even more perilous. You'd have this I-want-one-too phenomenon, Downing says, And so the SWAT teams get bigger, and they start to spread, and standards would start to drop. You have to be very careful about who you put on the SWAT team. The guys who want it most are the last ones who should be given a spot. At LAPD, you were choosing from a force of 9,000 strong. You're getting elite, disciplined officers, and the pool is big enough that you can screen them. For fitness and marksmanship, and all the usual stuff. But also for attitude and psychology. Choosiness isn't a luxury at smaller police agencies. Right now, I'm preparing to testify in a lawsuit stemming from a wrong-headed raid by a SWAT team in a 28-man police department, Downing says. How do you even begin to select from 28 people? Several officers interviewed for this book made the intuitive point that the officers who want to be on the SWAT team are the last officers who should be selected for it. And how do they find time to train? At LAPD, the SWAT team will spend at least half their on-duty time in training. In these smaller towns, the SWAT team is something these guys do on the side. They're patrol officers. And so what happens is that they train by practicing on the people. In the September 2011 issue of Tactical Edge magazine, Ed Sano, a SWAT leader in Benton County, Indiana, and a well-published author and consultant on police tactics, suggests doing exactly that, practicing SWAT raids on low-level offenders. Team commanders must raise the profile of their teams, Sano writes. Stay active. Yes, I mean, do warrant service and drug raids, even if you have to poach the work. First, your team needs the training time under true call-out conditions. If all your team does is train but seldom deploy, you will end up training just to train. You need to train to fight. Make deploying SWAT something that is routine, not something only done after much hand-wringing. As had been happening throughout the drug war, this mass militarization brought with it a new wave of dehumanization. In one follow-up interview to his survey, a SWAT commander told Kraska, referring to the use of his team for routine patrols, "When the soldiers ride in, you should see those blacks scatter." Former San Jose Police Chief Joseph McNamara told National Journal in 2000 that at a recent SWAT conference he had attended, officers were wearing these very disturbing shirts. On the front, there were pictures of SWAT officers dressed in dark uniforms, wearing helmets, and holding submachine guns. Below was written, "We don't do drive-by shootings." On the back, there was a picture of a demolished house. Below was written, "We stop." Kraska found more evidence of the mindset problem in a separate ethnography study he conducted. As part of the study, he had been invited to sit in on an informal and probably illegal training session for police officers. The session was taught by two members of an elite military unit with whom he had become friendly, and who worked with several police departments that were developing or in the process of developing SWAT-like units. The actual training turned out to be little more than a group of cops and soldiers gathering in a remote area to shoot big guns. But before the police officers arrived, Kraska talked to the trainers about the proliferation of SWAT teams. "This shit is going on all over," one of them said. "Why serve an arrest warrant to some crack dealer with a .38? With full armor, the right shit, and training, you can kick ass and have fun." The other trainer jumped in. "Most of these guys just like to play war. They get a rush out of search-and-destroy missions instead of the bullshit they do normally." When the trainees arrived, all active-duty cops, either on a SWAT team or soon to be, Kraska described what he saw. Several had lightweight retractable combat knives strapped to their belts. Three wore authentic army fatigue pants with T-shirts. One wore a T-shirt that carried a picture of a burning city with gunship helicopters flying overhead and the caption, "Operation Ghetto Storm." Another wore a tight black T-shirt with the initials NTOA for National Tactical Officers Association. A few of the younger officers wore Oakley wraparound sunglasses on heads that sported either flat tops or military-style crew cuts. The Oakleys and crew cuts were part of a muscle-bound, mechanistic look popular with younger police officers. The look was usually accessorized with sensory enhancement gear, like night vision goggles, to achieve what Kraska calls a techno-warrior image. He notes that one purveyor of SWAT gear and clothing calls its line, Cyborg 21st. Later, Kraska wrote, a guy who had served as a sniper, both in the military and on a SWAT team, put on a demonstration for the group. The rest of the officers sat in awe as he popped off head-sized jugs of water, sitting behind plates of glass. The sniper, Kraska observed, was held in especially high esteem in the paramilitary subculture because he embodied the skill, discipline, endurance, and mindset necessary to execute people from long distances in a variety of situations. Most interesting are Kraska's observations about his own state of mind during the training session. There's a point in his narrative where one of the trainers asks him if he wants to take a turn with an MP5. Kraska is reluctant, but after some prodding, gives the weapon a try. I fired at a body-sized target, and, just as this officer surely anticipated, I made all the mistakes of someone who had never fired an automatic. He took some ribbing, and then was surprised to hear himself defending his masculinity to the group of virtual strangers by pointing out that he had grown up hunting with shotguns. Presented with a shotgun, he then redeemed himself with what he calls a personally satisfying demonstration. Kraska found himself working hard to fit in and win the approval of the officers, even though he was there as an observer and likely would never see them again. He also felt a rush of power. I had an intense sense of operating on the boundary of legitimate and illegitimate behavior. Clearly, much of the activity itself was illegal, although reporting it would never have resulted in it being defined as criminal. I felt at ease and in some ways defiant. I've had this experience in the past when field-researching police officers, and I realize that, in a sense, I am basking in the security of my temporary status as a beneficiary of state-sanctioned use of force. This is likely the same intoxicating feeling of autonomy from the law that is experienced by an abusive police officer. On a personal level, what disturbed me most was how I, as a person who had so thoroughly thought out militarism, could have so easily enjoyed experiencing it. This study illustrates the expansive and seductive powers of a deeply embedded ideology of violence. The officers with SWAT and dynamic entry experience interviewed for this book say raids are orders of magnitude more intoxicating than anything else in police work. Ironically, many cops describe them with language usually used to describe the drugs the raids are conducted to confiscate. Oh, it's a huge rush, Franklin says. Those times when you do have to kick down a door, it's just a big shot of adrenaline. Downing agrees. It's a rush, and you have to be careful because the raids themselves can be habit-forming. Jamie Haas, a former special agent with Immigration and Customs Enforcement who went on multiple narcotics, money laundering, and human trafficking raids, says the thrill of the raid may factor into why narcotics cops just don't consider less volatile means of serving search warrants. The thing is, it's so much safer to wait the suspect out, he says. Waiting people out is just so much better. You've done your investigation, so you know their routine. So you wait until the guy leaves, and you do a routine traffic stop, and you arrest him. That's the safest way to do it. But you have to understand that a lot of these cops are meatheads. They think this stuff is cool, and they get hooked on that jolt of energy they get during a raid. The 1996 election may have represented a turning point in public opinion about marijuana. Despite heavy campaigning by the office of Clinton's drug czar, Barry McCaffrey, and the federal government in general, California voters overwhelmingly passed a ballot initiative to legalize marijuana for medical purposes. Arizona voters passed an even more permissive law, but the state legislature effectively repealed it the following year. Over the next 16 years, 17 more states and the District of Columbia would pass medical marijuana laws, 11 of them through ballot initiatives. And all of this led to the historic 2012 election results, in which voters in Washington State and Colorado legalized the drug outright. But the federal government wasn't about to let sick people just start smoking pot without a fight. After the 1996 election, McCaffrey called a press conference to denounce California voters. Nothing has changed, McCaffrey said. This is not a medical proposition. This is the legalization of drugs that we're concerned about. This is not medicine. This is a Cheech and Chong show. And now, What we are committed to doing is to look in a scientific way at any proposition that would bring a new medicine to the assistance of the American medical establishment. Naturally, there was no such medicine in the offing. Months later, the Clinton administration announced that doctors who recommended pot to their patients would not only lose their DEA licenses, but could also face criminal charges. In 2000, a federal judge chastised the Clinton administration for threatening doctors who even mentioned the medical benefits of marijuana to their AIDS and cancer patients. The medical marijuana fight also began what would become a new and especially disturbing chapter in the story of police militarization in America. The use of heavy-handed paramilitary raids to send a political message. When the DEA began raiding marijuana suppliers in California, and then also in the states that subsequently legalized the drug, they generally raided suspects who were either well-known supporters of pot or people who they believed had enormous supplies of the drug. The latter were people running businesses, operating openly under state law. Many of them had obtained business licenses and permits, as well as permission from local law enforcement. These were not dangerous people. The use of tactical teams and frightening raids to shut down medical marijuana suppliers in California was about sending a clear, unambiguous message to other pot suppliers around the state. Openly defy the federal government, and you can expect the blunt force of federal power to be brought down upon you. One of those early raids was on a medical marijuana farm run by Todd McCormick and Peter McWilliams in the Los Angeles neighborhood of Bel Air. Both men had become advocates of the drug after using it to treat symptoms of their own serious illnesses. McCormick smoked pot to treat the pain associated with a cancer treatment that had fused two of his vertebrae. McWilliams had both AIDS and non-Hodgkin's lymphoma, brought on by AIDS. Smoking marijuana relieved his nausea, which helped him keep down the medication he took both to manage his AIDS and during his chemotherapy for the cancer. McWilliams was also a self-help author and had become an outspoken civil liberties activist. With respect to pot, he made no attempt to hide the fact that while it was saving his life, it also made him feel good. The pot helped him keep down his medicine, dulled the pain associated with his conditions, and took his mind off the fact that he was suffering from them. None of that was enough to get McCormick and McWilliams out from under the boot of the federal government. McWilliams describes the first moments of the raid. A hard pounding on the door, accompanied by shouts of, "Police, open up," broke the silence, broke my reverie, and nearly broke down the door. I opened the door wearing standard writer's attire, a bathrobe, and was immediately handcuffed. I was taken outside, while Drug Enforcement Administration, DEA, agents ran through my house, guns drawn, commando style. They were looking, I suppose, for the notorious, well-armed, highly trained medical marijuana militia. To the DEA, I am the godfather of the medicine cartel. Finding nothing, they took me back into my home, informed me that I was not under arrest, and ordered me, still in handcuffs, to sit down. I was merely being restrained, I was told, so the DEA could enforce the search warrant. The two men were unquestionably growing marijuana. The police found some 4,000 plants. The entire operation was legal under California law, but because they were brought up on federal charges and tried in federal court, a jury wouldn't be allowed to hear anything about California law. McWilliams was also barred from telling the jury that, according to his doctors, marijuana was keeping him alive. Because all of that information would be kept from any potential jury, McWilliams really had no choice but to plead guilty and hope for leniency. After his arrest, McWilliams's mother put her house up as collateral to help post his bail. One of the conditions of McWilliams's bail was that he refrain from smoking marijuana. Federal prosecutors told McWilliams's mother that if he failed a drug test or was caught with even a trace of pot in his possession, they'd take her house. So, to protect his mother, McWilliams refrained from using the drug. He died before he could be sentenced. McWilliams was found dead in his apartment on June 14, 2000. Overcome with nausea, he had choked and aspirated on his own vomit. Tributes popped up all over the political spectrum. Conservative icon and pot champion William F. Buckley devoted a column to eulogizing McWilliams. Drug war reformers and libertarians snapped up his book and probably his most lasting legacy, "Ain't Nobody's Business If You Do," an eloquent defense of John Stuart Mill's harm principle. And yet to those on the other side, the federal prosecutors who went after him, the DEA agents who raided him, Barry McCaffrey, Janet Reno, and Bill Clinton, Peter McWilliams was just more collateral damage. When Bill Clinton took office in 1993, crime in America was still climbing. The concept of community policing was growing increasingly popular. Ideally, community policing is the sort of thing implemented by law enforcement officials like Norm Stamper in San Diego, Nick Pastore in New Haven, and, as we'll see, Joseph McNamara in San Jose. Rather than taking a call-and-response approach to policing, which focuses on aspects of policing like increasing response times to 911 calls, cops walk regular beats, they go to community meetings, they know the names of the principals of the schools in their district, and they know and consult with community and neighborhood leaders. It's a more proactive form of policing, but one that stresses making cops a part of the places they work. In 1994, Clinton started a new grant program under the Justice Department called Community-Oriented Policing Services, or COPS. For its inaugural year, Clinton and leaders in Congress, most notably Senator Joe Biden, funded it with $148.4 million. The next year, funding jumped to $1.42 billion, and it stayed in the neighborhood of $1.5 billion through 1999. COPS grants were mostly intended to go to police departments to hire new police officers, ostensibly for the purpose of implementing more community-oriented policing strategies. The problem was that there was no universal definition of community policing. Most law enforcement officials and academics agree that community policing is a more proactive approach to policing than call and response. But within that general agreement is a huge range of approaches. The style of community policing embraced by officials like Pastore and Stamper aims to make police a helpful presence in the community, not an occupying presence. But theirs is not the only way to be proactive about law enforcement. Street sweeps, occupation-like control of neighborhoods, SWAT raids, and aggressive anti-gang policies are also proactive. These police activities are aggressive, often violent, and usually a net loss for civil liberties. But they are proactive. When Clinton, Biden, and other politicians touted the COPS program, they did so with language that evoked the Peace Corps approach, though both Clinton and Biden also supported policies that promoted militarization. Although Clinton described the goal of COPS as building bonds of understanding and trust between police and citizens, it wasn't clear if he or any other politician really believed this. The majority of the funding in COPS grants was given simply to hire more police officers. The program said little about how those officers should be used, or what sort of attitude they should bring to the job. Moreover, while Congress regularly makes federal funding contingent on states passing a particular law or policy, think speed limits or drunk driving laws tied to federal highway funding, it's much more difficult to dictate how a police department puts a big federal grant to work in day-to-day operations. And so, as the COPS program threw billions at police departments under the pretense of hiring whistling, baton-twirling officer friendlies to walk neighborhood beats, rescue kittens, and maybe guest umpire the occasional Little League game, many police agencies were actually using the money to militarize. One of the first to notice what was going on was Portland journalist Paul Richmond. The unfortunate truth about community policing as it is currently being implemented is that it is anything but community-based, Richmond wrote in a 1997 article for the alternative newspaper PDXS. Instead, he wrote, in Portland, the grants had resulted in increased militarization of the police force. Richmond also found in Portland that, ironically, or perhaps not, a federal program touted as a way to encourage local police to get more involved with local communities was actually federalizing local law enforcement. At the same time Clinton was pushing COPS, the administration and Democrats in Congress were pushing policies like troops-to-COPS bills, management training programs for police agencies based on federal models of policing, and a bill that would allow local police departments to fund community policing programs with asset forfeiture money obtained through the Justice Department's Equitable Sharing Program, the program that allows local police departments to ignore state forfeiture laws by teaming up with the federal government. Another bill would have established a 2,500-person federal rapid deployment force, essentially a small standing army, that states and cities could call upon to swoop in for special crime and drug-fighting missions. The same bill would also have directed yet more funding to create joint federal-state-local anti-drug task forces. Richmond found that while the overall cops-to-citizens ratio fell in the early 1990s, in Portland, between 1989 and 1994, the number of officers in the city's Tactical Operations Department jumped from 2 to 56. The two officers in charge of the city's tactical teams had formerly been in charge of the city's Department of Community Policing. Richmond also obtained a copy of the city's Community Policing Strategic Plan, passed by the City Council in 1994. Among the plan's objectives was to increase the police department's involvement with the federal ATF and the Oregon National Guard. It included implementing, at a local level, Clinton's One Strike and You're Out plan for drug use in public housing, which allowed for raids on public housing tenants, followed by their possible eviction, based on no more than an anonymous tip. Richmond was alarmed that so many progressives in the city were embracing the community policing plan based on little more than its pleasant-sounding name, and that it was coming from a Democratic administration in Washington and administered by a progressive city government. The devil was in the details, and no one had bothered to look at the details. Little of this would have surprised Peter Kraschke. All of the police departments he surveyed that had a SWAT team also claimed to place high emphasis on the Democratic approach to community policing. Kraschke found that when most law enforcement officials heard community policing, they thought of the militarized zero-tolerance model. To them, the idea of a police agency simultaneously militarizing and implementing community policing policies was perfectly reasonable. In fact, 2 out of 3 departments Kraschke surveyed said their SWAT team was actually part of their community policing strategy. Surprising as that may seem at first glance, it went hand in hand with the increasing use of these tactical teams for routine patrols. In 2001, a Madison Capital Times investigation found that 65 of Wisconsin's 83 local SWAT teams had come into being since 1980, 28 of them since 1996, and 16 in just the previous year. In other words, more than half of the state's SWAT teams had popped up since the inaugural year of the COPS program. The newer tactical units had sprung up in absurdly small jurisdictions like Forest County, population 9,950. Muckwonago, 7,519, and Rice Lake, 8,320. Many of the agents who populated these new SWAT teams, the paper found, had been hired with COPS grants. A local criminologist was incredulous. Community policing initiatives and stockpiling weapons and grenade launchers are totally incompatible. Perhaps that was true in theory, but not in how community policing was being practiced. Of course, Byrne grants and the 1033 program had also contributed to the SWATification of the dairy state. The paper found that in the 1990s, Wisconsin police departments hauled in over 100,000 pieces of military equipment, valued at more than $18 million. Columbia County alone, home to all of 52,000 people, made out with 5,000 military items, valued at $1.75 million. Some of the bounty was benign, items like computers and office equipment, but it also included 11 M-16s, 21 bayonets, 4 boats, a periscope, and 41 vehicles, one of which was converted into a mobile command center for the SWAT team. Columbia County also received surveillance equipment, cold weather gear, tools, battle dress uniforms, flak jackets, and chemical suits. The county put its tactical team to use by sending it to Weedstock in nearby Sauk County, an event where cops in full SWAT attire intimidatingly stood guard, while hundreds of young people gathered peacefully to smoke marijuana and listen to music. Moreover, the Capital Times found that the state distributed the burn grants, cops grants, and block law enforcement grants it received from Washington to local police agencies based solely on their drug policing statistics. The size of the disbursements was directly tied to the number of city or county drug arrests. Each drug-related arrest, the paper found, brought in $153 to each local police department. Jackson County quadrupled its drug arrests between 1999 and 2000. Correspondingly, the county's state-distributed federal law enforcement subsidies quadrupled too. Several jurisdictions brought in enough in grants alone to more than cover the cost of starting a SWAT team. This is how the game is played. Drug arrests brought in federal money. Federal money and 1033 let police departments buy cool battle garb to start a SWAT team, which they justified to local residents by playing to fears of terrorism, school shootings, and hostage takings. But those sorts of events are not only rare, they don't bring in any additional money. Drug raids bring in more federal funding, plus the possibility of asset forfeiture. All in the name of community policing. During the 2008 campaign, Barack Obama and Joe Biden, but especially Biden, credited the COPS program as the reason behind America's historic crime drop that began in 1994. Biden's campaign website during the 2008 primaries exclaimed, "In the 1990s, the Biden crime bill, an incarnation of the final bill establishing COPS, added 100,000 cops to America's streets. As a result, murder and violent crime rates went down 8 years in a row." The Justice Department's Inspector General put the new COPS number closer to 60,000, and a Heritage Foundation analysis found that, accounting for attrition, the total number of cops on the streets increased between 6,000 and 40,000. More to the point, there's little evidence that the crime drop was a result of the program. A 2005 report by the Government Accountability Office found that while the violent crime rate dropped 32% between 1993 and 2000, at most, the COPS program accounted for 2.5% of that decrease, and at a cost of $8 billion. A 2007 analysis in the peer-reviewed academic journal Criminology concluded that COPS spending had little to no effect on crime. In 2007, I was asked to speak about police militarization at a crime summit hosted by Representative Bobby Scott of Virginia, the Democratic chairman of the House Subcommittee on Crime. During a question-and-answer session, someone asked about community policing and the possibility of restoring full funding to the COPS grants. The Bush administration had phased the program out. Everyone seemed to be in favor of the Peace Corps model of community policing, and they also seemed to believe that this was what the COPS grants were funding. Pointing to the Madison Capital Times investigation and Kraska's research, I explained that these idealized visions of community policing didn't appear to have much to do with how the grants were actually being used. Representative Scott stopped me. "Are you telling me that our community policing grants are being used to start and fund SWAT teams?" I responded that, yes, that was what Kraska and the Madison paper had found. Scott replied with a bit of whimsy, "Well, that's not really what we intended." The room had a good chuckle. The next year, the Democrats increased funding to the COPS program by $40 million. The following year, with Obama in the White House, the program's budget increased 250% to $1.55 billion. Early Monday morning, the chief of detectives requests an urgent meeting with the police chief. At the meeting, he tells the police chief that the department's op-narc, Detective Everready, has gathered intelligence indicating that Mad Dog Brown, one of the city's more well-known drug dealers, has obtained a large shipment of rock cocaine. Mad Dog, who is credited by police with killing a number of rival dealers after giving them a mad dog look, has said he will never be taken alive. The intelligence indicates that Mad Dog has obtained enough rock cocaine to supply the city's drug users for a month. He is reportedly held up in a fortified apartment on the third floor of a public housing project and surrounded by colleagues armed with military-type assault rifles. That was the scenario Joseph McNamara set up to kick off the afternoon panel he was moderating for a groundbreaking drug policy conference in 1997 at the Hoover Institution. McNamara was a fellow at Hoover, the conservative think tank affiliated with Stanford University. More than 100 police chiefs, judges, prosecutors, civil rights and civil liberties leaders, drug treatment professionals, and academics had gathered for the event, which was covered by C-SPAN. It was likely the first event of its kind, and if not, it was certainly the most high profile. McNamara, who had 35 years' experience in law enforcement, himself had become a critic of the drug war and police militarization. But the Hoover name gave the event some credibility with conservatives and law enforcement officials. Speakers included Milton Friedman, former Secretary of State George Shultz, Baltimore Mayor Kurt Schmoke, Baltimore Police Commissioner Thomas Frazier, Ed Meese, California Judge James Gray, and San Jose, California Mayor Susan Hammer. McNamara himself started his career as a patrol officer in Harlem in the 1960s, where he walked one of the highest crime beats in the country. He worked his way up through the NYPD, achieving the rank of lieutenant before accepting a criminal justice fellowship at Harvard. Under the fellowship, he studied the operations of a methadone clinic back in Harlem, which spurred his interest in drug policy. McNamara went on to earn a doctorate in public administration. His dissertation was an examination of how law enforcement handled drug use in America before and after the 1913 Harrison Narcotics Act. After completing his doctorate, he returned to the NYPD as a deputy inspector in charge of crime analysis. In 1973, McNamara was appointed police chief in Kansas City. 3 years later, he was appointed police chief for San Jose, California. He headed that department for 15 years. McNamara resisted the aggressive, militaristic trends brought on by the drug war in the 1980s. He embraced community policing and showed little tolerance for police misconduct and excessive force. By the time he retired in 1991, San Jose had surpassed San Francisco to become the most populous city in Northern California. Among cities with a population of 400,000 or more, San Jose also had the lowest crime rate in the country for the last 3 years of McNamara's tenure. The city's crime rate in 1990 was 60% of San Diego's, half that of San Francisco, and one quarter of the rate in Los Angeles. McNamara pulled this off with one of the smallest per capita police departments in America. That record and his own conservative politics won McNamara clout with the right, despite his vocal criticism of the war on drugs, police abuse, and police militarization. It also helped him land his post-law enforcement position with Hoover shortly after retirement. In 1995, McNamara won funding to conduct 4 drug policy conferences at Hoover. The first was in 1995. The panel he was moderating in 1997 was the second. McNamara's co-panelists for the militarization session were Los Angeles Police Chief Bernard Parks, U.S. District Judge Robert Sweet, San Jose Mayor Hammer, Defense Attorney Ron Rose, San Francisco District Attorney Terrence Hallinan, ACLU Executive Director Ira Glasser, former Santa Clara, California NAACP Director Tommy Fulcher, and Robert Garner of the Drug Abuse Services Bureau in Santa Clara. After laying out the hypothetical above, McNamara turned to Chief Parks. What was his next move? Parks responded that he'd attempt to verify the tip. If it checked out, he'd send in the SWAT team. McNamara asked about the sort of ammunition the SWAT team used. Weren't there bullets capable of going through walls? They'll go through a car engine 2 blocks away, Parks answered. McNamara then changed the hypothetical. What if it wasn't crack but marijuana? Would he still send in an armed-to-the-teeth SWAT team? Parks said he would. What if it was a shipment of bootlegged Valium? Still with the SWAT team. Black market booze. SWAT team. Mayor Hammer was up next. What was her role in overseeing the police department? Would she be comfortable with her own police department conducting a heavy-handed SWAT raid in a crowded housing complex over illegal Valium? Hammer replied that her job was to support the chief, not to question him. If the raid had gone over poorly with the public, she might go on TV to reassure the city. She added that she doubted whether such raids did anything at all to reduce the drug supply, but that the raid needed to be carried out anyway. I don't know how you don't do the raid and have any credibility with the community. McNamara then turned to D.A. Hallinan. He, too, said it wasn't his job to question police tactics. Even if he thought the raid was too dangerous or an unnecessary use of force, he'd keep his opinions to himself. It just wasn't his job to tell the police chief whether or not he thought a raid was appropriate. McNamara also asked Sweet, the federal judge, if he'd sign a warrant to make the raid a no-knock in each of the various hypotheticals. Since Nixon first pushed the no-knock policy, politicians and police officials had stated over and over again that the tactic would be monitored and patrolled by the judges who must sign off on the search warrants. Sweet said that while he worried about the drug war's erosion of the Fourth Amendment, he and most judges typically didn't second-guess or provide much scrutiny to affidavits requesting no-knock search warrants. After the fact, they might hear a defendant's argument that contraband seized in the raid should be suppressed because the raid was unreasonable. But in his experience, judges rarely gave any consideration to whether the use of a SWAT team and paramilitary, volatile entry tactics were an appropriate use of force for the crime under investigation. It went on like that. Even Glasser and Fulcher, the civil liberties activists, said they'd become involved only if they received complaints from residents of the housing complex about police misconduct after the raid. They likely wouldn't devote any resources to criticizing the tactics themselves. Garner, the panelist who had an extensive public health background and who ran Santa Clara's public addiction clinic, added that police in his community had never in his career consulted him about the extent of the drug problem in Santa Clara, be it about which drugs were most prevalent, which drugs presented more of a public health threat than others, or what sorts of policies would best minimize the harm caused by addiction. Finally, McNamara asked the panel, if the drug raid was a complete and total success, resulting in a confiscation of Mad Dog's entire stash with no casualties to police, suspects, or citizens, would it have any impact on drug abuse in your city? All but Chief Parks said no. The police chief of the second largest city in America had just told the audience that he was willing to use extraordinary force to confiscate a supply of illegal drugs. It was a level of force that could well result in death or injury to innocents, and indeed, by that point already had, countless times. What's more, he added that what drug he was pursuing and how much actual harm that particular drug caused had no relevance on the amount of force he elected to use. Every public official on the panel who had the power to check that decision then told the same audience that they had no interest in second-guessing him. During a question-and-answer session after the panel, the public officials in the audience basically reaffirmed what the panelists had already said. It really showed the extent of the problem, McNamara says. You get this robot mentality with these officials. The mayor said she knew nothing about these raids and didn't want to know anything about them until they were over. The judge wasn't interested in scrutinizing the raid until it was over, when any damage would already be done. Everyone else said it wasn't their job to worry about it. And so you end up with this dangerous decision that gets made by people of lower rank, with little training, with little incentive to care much about constitutional rights, with no oversight, no checks or balances. Collateral damage is just part of the game. In a paper on the conference that McNamara later submitted to the International Congress on Alcohol and Drug Dependence, he concluded, "The session revealed that public officials, judges, mayors, district attorneys, police chiefs, public health directors, and community leaders rarely, if ever, meet as a group to discuss urban drug control goals and problems, and they never meet to discuss police drug raids unless something goes awry. Each of the panelists indicated a sensitivity to problems of drug control, appropriate police conduct, and public safety, but felt that his or her role was basically compartmentalized. Another troubling theme to emerge from the 1997 conference is that police, judges, and prosecutors, the people most closely connected with the drug war, other than drug offenders themselves, were afraid to speak openly and honestly, even in an academic setting. One police chief cornered McNamara to voice his displeasure with McNamara inviting media to cover the conference. He said the presence of reporters made him and other drug war critics reluctant to talk candidly. In response to a questionnaire about overall impressions of the conference, one police chief wrote, "The conference reinforced my feelings that we need to change." A prosecutor wrote that the event confirmed my views that the war on drugs cannot be justified logically or economically. New approaches are needed, and soon. Another police chief wrote, "The conference gave me a strong sense of the need for changing drug policies." And still another wrote, "It is risky for us to even attend a conference which could lead to an accusation of being soft on drugs." A judge wrote that the conference challenged many of my views, but all of them requested anonymity. There's a strong argument that Larry Phillips Jr. and Emil Matasarianu did more to advance the militarization of American police forces than anyone short of Daryl Gates. Phillips and Matasarianu, a Romanian immigrant, met at a Gold's Gym in the late 80s, struck up a friendship, and embarked on a decade-long crime spree together. By the time they were preparing a heist of a Bank of America in North Hollywood, California in early 1997, they had robbed two armored cars and two other branches of Bank of America. On the morning of February 28th, the two suited up in body armor and loaded a Chevrolet Celebrity with six guns and over 3,000 rounds of ammunition. The robbery went down with no casualties, though the two were disappointed to make out with only a little over $300,000, less than half of what they were expecting. But as they left the bank at around 9:30 a.m., several LAPD patrol cars had already showed up and formed an embankment, the officers taking cover behind their squad cars. Phillips and Matasarianu fired off several rounds at one of the cars. The police fired back. The shootout was on.